RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Harvey Week is a 30-year veteran of the petrochemical industry. He's passionate about New Zealand's economic success and the role of the energy sector. You might have heard Harvey being interviewed on the Greenwashed show, and I can tell you when that was, back on the 8th of April this year. One of Harvey's biggest achievements was his successful efforts to maintain a viable methanol operation at Methanex in Taranaki after the 2003 Maui gas redetermination slashed the company's feedstock supplies. And Harvey is back to talk with us again on this show because I'm curious to find out from somebody in the know, what they think of the government actions on energy so far. So, Harvey, thanks for coming on RCR Breakfast. It's great to have you. Thanks for coming on.
Yep, no problems there, Paul.
Okay, so the government's actions so far are, what do you reckon?
Well, obviously, a big improvement on the previous regime. So allowing for the exploration of oil and gas is brilliant. And also reviewing, you know, the situation with Marsden Point. Tragically, it was prematurely closed down. Obviously, I understand how the perspective of the oil companies in terms of, you know, utilising spare refining capacity in Asia. So I understand their economics okay, but at the end of the day, they're not the ones that ultimately carry the risk of non-supply. No. It's New Zealanders that carry that risk. And while the probability of a non-supply is small, it's not zero and it's not 50-50 over the next 10 years, but I would put it more like between 1 in 10 and 1 in 5 over the next 10 years.
Okay.
So it's not insignificant. It's happened before. People with longer memories will recall we had supply disruptions for a couple of years during the 1970s and we had Carless Days.
I remember the Carless Days. I do.
So, and on the back of all of that pain, the only thing that we ever talked about then, as would happen again, that would be the only subject, because how do you feed a population of 5 million people without fuel?
Yeah.
So it's a very, very serious issue. And so I think we've underestimated the scale of the consequence in the event of a non-supply. Now, I'm not saying Marsden is the only option available to us, but it was part of a mix of resiliency. And that mix has been taken away, assuming that equipment, I don't know the status of the equipment today, but if the equipment hasn't been mothballed or removed, then clearly there's a real option to spend some capital and restart it.
Yeah, I think that's a New Zealand first policy or something that they want to do. The recklessness of allowing that to happen seems to be, well, how do you explain it? Because it's common sense, isn't it?
Well,
to start down the bottom of the world and
Well, the thing is that if you believe your own narrative long enough, you'll believe that that's true. And you know, we were on a path, we're supposedly on a path to zero carbon by 2050, and it's not going to happen. All we're going to do is you know, damage the economy. And so all we're really doing with that policy is shifting all of the carbon burden to other countries. We're not actually achieving anything globally at all. But all we're doing fundamentally is reducing our resilience. And the shutting down of Marsden Point is only one step of many that have occurred over decades that is chipping away at our energy resilience. And it all came to a head in the 1970s when we had loss of supply. And with fuel rationing and Carless Days, that was the birth of the Think Big thinking. And the whole purpose of that was to build resiliency so that we could be 50% self-sufficient in transport fuels by the mid-1980s, which we achieved. But since that time, or since the 1990s, we've been on a steady decline. And we've really not focused on it as a nation because it's out of memory. You know, we've forgotten what the consequence might be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if we can't restart Marsden Point, then as a very bare minimum, we should be having 60 days of supply of each of the individual fuels in New Zealand onshore. If you look at the European nations, most of those countries have 60 days of supply, and they're way close to the Middle East and the North Sea and West Africa than New Zealand is. So at a bare minimum, I would suggest that 60 days would give us enough time to swing supplies out of the US Gulf Coast into the country where they're previously not coming prior.
What is our buffer at the moment?
Well, I don't actually know the number to that. It's certainly less than 30 days, but I don't know precisely. You know, does it depend? The oil companies are arguing, you know, are the tanks and the service stations counted? You know, what's in and what's out? What's the time period, et cetera? So, you know, those machinations, I'm not privy to that detail. But it's certainly less than 30 days.
Yeah, so it could go south pretty quick, couldn't it?
Very quickly. And the thing is that you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see that, you know, there are different scenarios that could easily play out in the Pacific region, you know, tomorrow or next year or who knows. But and those scenarios could impact the all of the refineries supplying this part of the world.
Yeah.
And so... Yeah.
Because if we're having trouble getting it, others will too, right?
Everyone will have trouble on the same dibs. And so each country will go into protection mode and protect the fuel for themselves. So, you know... The refineries, so the world's going to be short of refining product for a period, so we're going to be in a queue, and it probably won't be in Asia, it'll probably be the US. And it takes time to get the ships up there, or redirected, fill them up and bring them down. You know, 30 days, it's just ain't enough.
Oh dear. Okay, and that resilience that was put in place, Think Big was the overarching name of the project, wasn't it? Think Big?
Yep.
Sounds like that's aged quite well. Do you think it has, that thinking and what was put in place back then?
Yeah, I think the thinking was pretty reasonable. The only thing I would, you know, in hindsight, I'd say that the government probably took a little bit too much risk in that. You know, the oil companies could have taken more risk, but nevertheless, you know, and once everything was in play built, we obviously had very cheap oil for the next 15 to 20 years. So, you know, the economics didn't quite turn out, but, you know, most of those facilities are still in operation today. So, you know.
Yeah. So if we were drilling for and recovering our own oil and refining it, it would be cheaper, would it?
It would clearly be cheaper because you're obviously not buying US dollars. You know, you're not buying oil in US dollars. You're basically paying for it in local currency. So, of course, it's beneficial to the nation. But you've got to find it. You've got to have an upstream industry that is well supported by the Crown, by the government, by the politicians, by the public. You know, what they do is very, very important to all of us. And so, and it's hard work, you know, fighting the geology. The geology in New Zealand is challenging. So geologically speaking, it's hard work anyway. So we need a really, really, you know, important and well-supported regime, both, you know, bipartisan, Labor and National, that endures over time, which is what we had up until this last government. And so I think it's going to take more than one. I think it's going to need some sort of bilateral arrangement between both parties to stay the course.
Like sort of like superannuation or something like that.
Exactly the same, because otherwise, you know, the oil companies are going to be, you know, frightened.
Yeah, we don't want that. We don't want frightened oil companies, I suppose. How long would it take to crank it all up again, do you think? Let's say, because, you know, the world is uncertain, right, Harvey? It's uncertain right now, and all sorts of supply lines could be blocked, constricted?
It depends on what the state of the equipment is at Marsden Point.
Yeah.
If the equipment is still there, it has not been demolished or removed, you could probably get it up and running within 12 to 15 months.
Right.
You know, we did that for Motunui, and Motunui had been decommissioned for 5 years.
Okay, yeah.
So we know we can do that. It's a big commitment. It's a lot of money. But again, if you look at the consequence, if you took a 1 in 10 year over a 10-year period, a loss of crude oil supply or oil product supply into New Zealand, which is about sort of somewhere between 6 and 8 billion a year, if that failed to materialize or was interrupted, that would jeopardize a $400+ billion economy. So, you know, you've spending a few hundred million on restarting the plant is chicken fry, really.
But if it's not in any sort of condition to sort of restart, and it's more damaged than that, it's a I take it building an oil refinery is not a quick thing to do.
No.
So they look complicated.
Not that complicated. You use the same site, and you'd probably or consider the possibility of using it, designing it as a topping refinery only. In other words, your residual crude you'd export back to Australia or Singapore, and just take off the jet fuel and the diesel and the gas oil and the petrol and the LPG. You know, that's a much cheaper proposition. And you could possibly tailor the design to include the possibility of, you know, forestry, you know, residue or fuel in the future. Mm. I don't know. You'd obviously consider it in the redesign, but you know that's probably a 5 to 10 year horizon to do that.
Gosh,
you know, it's such a big job.
Well. Yeah. And in the end, people have to remember, don't they, that the economy, cost of living, our standard of living, in the end, really, all there is in the end is energy, isn't there?
Well, without the energy, you've got no economy.
Yeah.
You know, you can't even get the milk off the farm. You can't get the supermarket shelves stocked. You can't do anything without fuel.
Yeah.
And electrification of transport's miles away. That's not going to happen in my lifetime. You know, it would run out of capital before that happened.
What about hydrogen, Harvey? How's that looking? I noticed there's some engine designs now kicking around.
Not likely. I think the most probable path forward is basically Toyota's hybrid technology. You know, basically using much, much less fuel with a small electric battery, you know, just like a Prius, you know,
yeah.
That type of concept. You can double the fuel efficiency. Doesn't really cost you a lot more. But if you're going to electrify transport, you know, you're going to have a drag of maybe 2 to 3% on GDP forever, every year. I just don't see it happening.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. So we'll run out of capital way, way before anything like that happens.
Do you think the current crop of politicians, and thinking of the ones who talk on energy, are aware of that? They must be.
I think unfortunately, Wellington tends to live in its own little cocoon, I'd say. You know, they go round and round circles with their view of the world, and I would suggest that their worldview is a little bit off the mark in terms of the institutions. I think reality is a little different from what people have believed it to be. Getting to net zero is just, you know, easy as peasy. Well, it's not. And I don't think it's realistic, and I don't think it's going to happen.
And it may not even be a thing we need to do anyway. So,
I think if what's going to happen is events are going to overtake us anyway, because you've got such a drop in the global birth rate that the population decline, the number of new births around the world is falling very, very fast.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we're going to have other challenges. I think this is the least of our issues.
Well, we want to keep the cost of living as low as possible in that case.
To do that, you've got to have low cost, reliable, and continuous energy, period. the same stuff that our you know, our forebears they focused on. You know, you think of back in the 1950s, Wellington didn't have power on the weekends for maybe 2 hours every day for years and years.
I didn't know that.
Wow. Until the hydroelectric system was built and connected up. We had unreliable power in this country just, you know, in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And then once the hydro system was built, you know, we had, you know, we just take it for granted that all the stuff works. Well, it's, you know, it's been absolutely brilliant for the country because the step up in our standard of living on the basis of that low cost and continuous energy is phenomenal.
Yeah. And Harvey, I want to get your comment on a couple of stories that have come over the weekend. I guess we expected them. First one is bill to resume oil and gas exploration set for later this year. So your reaction to that?
Well, it's a brilliant move, obviously. It was a stupid move to ban it in the first place. You know, 50 years ago, you know, fossil fuels represented just over 80% of the total primary energy demand globally. Today, it's still at about 80%. And although the market is much bigger, and at current levels of investment around the world at just over $1 trillion a year, that in renewables will see that the proportion of fossil fuels in total primary energy demand will be kept about constant. So in 20 years' time, we'll still be at about 80% of total primary energy demand.
So all those targets, what do they mean?
So
all those renewable
New Zealand's
targets.
No different. You know, we run at about, I think, 66% of our economy, primary energy demands, fossil fuel, you know, oil, gas and coal. And that's not likely to change over the next 20 years either. So what we see is oil and gas exploration represents a direction to improve New Zealand's energy resiliency. And what I mean by that is we need many diverse sources, including wind farms, including some of the renewables. That's all good. But we need everything, not select just the ones that we think are the best. So we need everything, and we need to reduce New Zealand's exposure to offshore risk. And so I think the next step would be for the government to reach out to Labor to see if they can do a bipartisan deal to make sure that this stays in the long-term strategy of the country.
Yeah.
You know, the geology in New Zealand is tough. New Zealand's a long way from market, so it's very challenging to put up a business case anyway. So anything that helps ease the risk burden is going to be helpful. And as if we do proceed with this, well, we're obviously now proceeding with it, if we find a gas field in New Zealand again, we're going to end up with lower sustained prices of power. We're going to see lower emissions both globally and within New Zealand because we'll substitute coal imports to keep the lights on when it's not windy and sunny. Or when we have a dry year when we haven't got enough water in the dams. So, you know, gas is a very, very fundamental feature of the economy.
What are the chances of finding more gas? I mean,
well,
I don't know.
It's tough. You know, there has been drilling in the last 5 years within Taranaki, within the existing blocks. So the geology is challenging. This is not a slam dunk. So even with this change in policy, it's not certain that we'll find a gas field still. It's a tough business. Big stakes. But if we do find something that's really big, it's a huge benefit to the country. And like I said, it would substitute importing coal. So it benefits our emissions profile at the same time.
Sounds like a no-brainer to put it into
it really does.
Everyday language. All right. And the mineral mining strategy has been unveiled by Shane Jones, who we'll have on shortly. So your reaction to that one?
Well, again, you know, if we want to be intellectually consistent, if we're supporting wind farms and EVs, then we have to support the mining of the minerals and the metals to achieve it. We can't expect just to have everyone else mine holes in the ground in order to get the EVs and the wind towers to New Zealand. That seems very lopsided and inconsistent. The trick, I think, with the minerals, like anything else with the mining, is that we've got to strike a very, very careful balance between protecting, you know, our ecosystem, you know, and the flora and flora and marine environment. We've got to respect that. But, you know, if you look off the coast of Kaffir today, you've got sea sands mining that's been doing that for 50 years or 40 years or whatever. That's on a heck of a big scale. No one's complaining about that. So I just think we're a little bit inconsistent. So I think as long as we've got reasonably, solid environmental real checks and balances, not made up stuff, I think we're okay.
Big reaction to this, well, all sorts of things, but sort of around climate and environment-related stuff in Auckland over the weekend. Do you think people are just having knee-jerk reactions without thinking it through? Because I can see where they're coming from, but they want their lights on, I would imagine.
Well, the thing is, if you take away energy, you know, because all of this is you're either mining something or you're burning something. It's one of the two. There's nothing else. If you want electric vehicles and you want windmills and solar farms, you need to dig it out of the ground. You need mining. And if you're not going to do that, you're going to be drilling. You can't have, it's either or. And so if you do nothing, you're going to end up with a shortfall of energy. And as soon as you've got a shortfall of energy, you've got a shortfall of food. And that will be the only thing that we will be thinking about and talking about.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think people just need to be a little bit mindful and educated on the integration of all of these issues. It's not a slam dunk. You can say all you like and protest all you like, but it doesn't actually change the physics of everything.
Let's see what people say. I'm sure there'll be some opinions emailed and texted through to us on this. So thanks for having a chat.
No problems. And thanks for having me on.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.